Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's August 23rd, 2020, and welcome to episode 220 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and terminals. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I'm joined today by two retro computing enthusiasts. The first on my screen is Blake Patterson in Northern Virginia. How are you?
I'm well. It's been a good bit of the day outside today. It's a nice, warm, but not insanely sweltering day, and good so far on this Sunday, so glad to be here and doing well.
It does seem like here in Boston, the summer is winding down a bit. I think we're about to be hit again by more heat, but
it was a bit warmer than yesterday, but there was a nice breeze and the humidity was low. It was nice to get outside when you can.
And also joining us is Jack Nutting from Stockholm. How are you?
Hello, everybody. I'm doing pretty well. I spent a good chunk of this weekend out at a friend's place, like out in the countryside, which was very, very nice. Nice weather and nice, like, I slept in an upstairs room with a balcony door wide open all night long. And it was never, like, too cold, never too hot. No street sounds, just, like, wind blowing in trees and ducks splashing in a pond. And very idyllic.
Nice. Very cool. Yep. Yeah, there's something that's pretty nice about sleeping outdoors. Like there's the place that we're in Montreal, often there's a little porch that we will sometimes sleep out on when it's, so it's like, if there's rain, it's not going to hit us directly. And, it's relatively easy to jump inside if necessary, but, if the bears come.
Right.
or whatever. But it is sort of pleasant to have the air.
Right.
Okay. Yep. And you're doing well in Boston there, Paul?
Yep. Yep. Everything is, I'm still inside, but I mean, otherwise, yes. So.
Well, no bears.
No bears. No.
Bear free.
Yep. Okay, so the topic for today, this is episode 220, and I think this reminded somebody of a DEC VT220 terminal.
Right.
So we thought that today's topic would be terminals. I'm actually not sure how iconic the VT220 is. The VT100 is. 102
yeah.
is.
Yeah, I don't really know. Like, I think about when Paul, you and I were in college, we had various labs. There were a few places that had clusters of VT-102s, maybe VT-100s also. And then we had mostly, there were some bigger spaces that had VT-320s and a few VT-220s. And, like, what was functionally different between those two, I don't really recall offhand. I remember using both, and they seemed about the same to me. But they were distinctly different from the VT-100s, which, like, the VT-100s looked like a big old clunky. They looked like they could be a whole computer with, like, a floppy drive stuck next to the monitor and stuff. Like, they looked kind of like some kind of TRS-80 machine or something, but it's just a terminal.
Right. And the computer labs with the VT-220s or 320s were sort of clearly they were just heads.
Yeah.
I guess that's how you would call them, right? I mean, like, it's the converse of a headless machine.
It's a thin client.
Oh, yes.
basically.
Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, I guess we were going to talk a little bit about just our experience with terminals, thoughts about terminals. I don't know. I think our topic was idea was one word long.
Yes. Terminals. Which is fine.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it doesn't need to be the sort of depressing thought of mortality.
It could just be not that kind of terminal.
Right.
We won't talk interminably about it.
So we can at some point we'll terminate this terminal discussion.
That's true. Well,
we're losing people, I see.
Yeah. Goodbye, everyone.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I don't know where to start. I mean, I guess we already did sort of start, but maybe, Blake, what thoughts did you have about terminals?
It's interesting. I guess the first terminal I encountered and used was at NASA Langley, there in Hampton, Virginia. My father worked as an aeronautical engineer for 35 years at NASA. And right outside of his office was a terminal of some sort. And it was there to access certain data. I know he used it rarely. Most of the people that worked under him would use it. But I was able to type around on it. And I had an Apple IIc at the time, which means it was probably 1984. And I remember being astounded at how clear the text was. I mean, it was either a VT-100 or a VT-220 or something that looked very similar. It was just the screen, the CRT and the keyboard. But there were no scan lines that I could perceive. You know, I'd never seen computer text that was that clear. And of course, the text terminals of the day were very high resolution, with their character sets they didn't really typically render actual graphics. But so I went home and I spent all this time trying to figure out what was wrong with my 2C, you know, that it had these scan lines, and I, you know, was getting new cable, bought cables, and I thought, why aren't the edges so perfectly smooth? And I would, there was no internet, so you couldn't really get on and search.
Right.
I think I might have mentioned it later on BBS. Does anybody know what's up? And finally I figured it out. But, you know, that, and I remember actually using the terminals at the public library when I was in, middle school, instead of the card catalog, you could use the terminals, and they were definitely VT something. They were DEC units, I remember. I thought that was really nifty. You'd print out your list of books, and at that point I liked everything, computery, this was still the point where you didn't see, when I was in the sixth, seventh grade, this was, 1984 or so, you did not see computers everywhere. You know, like, it was still kind of a big deal when, oh, look, he's got an IBM PC on his office desk. That's unusual. I mean, they weren't ubiquitous as they are now.
Right.
So it was always cool to use them. And I've actually never, I might circle back on this. I'm trying to dig through some people on IRC. There's a certain terminal that I had a desire to actually acquire. It's a nifty little small svelte thing. I'll see if I can figure out what that was. I can't remember it. But I've never actually purchased a straight-up terminal. I mean, which I guess is the case of most normal humans. Not that we're normal humans. But if I had a dime for every person out there that could say, I've never actually purchased a straight-up terminal. It's not an exclusive yet. But the closest thing, and I guess it feels closest because there was a version of this machine that was just a dumb terminal. I have a TRS-80 Model 4, which I think is one of the sexier, shaped machines. I know Carrington, if he were here, is very much on board with me on that. It has the two drives on the side and the integrated screen. It looks very computery. You know, it looks like the future of computers as we saw it in the 70s or whatever. But they had a version of that lacked the floppy drives. I mean, there was a version of it that lacked the floppy drives and just used cassette tape. And that was the low end, model for people that, wanted to buy the low end. But there also was a terminal that I don't think it even had a cassette jack, and it had a big covering the two bays. On the side was a big, perforated, seal, and it had, huge terminal, Tandy terminal logo. So this is a machine that had been stripped down and, offered as a terminal. So I guess it's the closest. As we've talked about in previous episodes, I'm really big into, BBSing and using a lot, as many of my existing machines as I can as serial terminals, which is easily done now with modern, modern assistants. So it's, basically you're running a program that is a terminal emulator, which is very well, describing what it does. It takes a regular computer, as all of us here know, and it makes it act like a VT-100 at the base or a VT-52. But at any rate, so I do a lot of that. But again, those aren't, you know, dedicated actual terminals. I guess that's the overall. I've never, I know some of the early terminals, quote unquote, were some of the teletype machines, or basically screenless terminals, you know, where you're printing on paper and typing a response. I've been in a room with one. There was one, for some reason, was donated to my middle school, and it was never used, but it sat in the corner, but I never used it. Yeah, so I've never actually spent time with something like that. But that's, I guess, in a nutshell, my terminal experience. Yeah, how about you guys?
Well, what do you think, Jack?
Well, I'm thinking back. I think probably the first terminal that I remember sort of like seeing in use was probably this kind of teletype thing. I seem to recall that the middle school I went to had something like that in the library. And it was not for students to use, really. It was something that could be used by people who were in the know somehow to connect to something. They probably connected to some kind of university library system to look up things in the index or whatever. I don't know what they did. But I remember it was there, and it was pretty much off limits. But it was more like when I went to college. And what strikes me is that these terminals, we had these Labsula terminals. This is before, I mean, students didn't have networking in the dorm rooms. Not everyone had a computer of their own. It was not ubiquitous. I mean, many of us did. But even if you did, the way to connect anything was you had to dial into a modem pool. There was, and those were limited. That was a limited resource. But there were these labs where everybody could go and sit down. You get an account and log in on this VMS system that they had. And so this, using these terminals, was kind of, that was really my first experience with networked computing in a sense. I mean, it was still, you know, we were all connected to one computer, but in the sense of humans being nodes on a network, in a sense, so that you could get on this thing and at the same time others were on, you could message people and you could email and that kind of thing. And there were discussion forums. And I remember someone had written clever programs that you could run that would show you a map of the room you were sitting in, all the terminals in it, and who was logged in each terminal. So if you could think, who's that guy two rows in front of me and to the right? You'd run this program and say, oh, it's that guy. It would look up the usernames and sort of cross-reference them somehow and draw a little diagram.
Yeah.
And I think it was, you know, this was not even the internet. I mean, we were on the internet, but like most of what was being done on those systems was just like, oh, here's messaging and here's discussion forums and whatnot. You could do some programming and stuff too. And I guess that's also, I mean, those terminals where I spent the first times that I played any kind of MUDs. By the same token, things like Rogue and Moria and NetHack and these things, like that, for me, my first time of playing all these things was on a VT320 sitting somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I did, like you said, like I remember really appreciating that the screens were all pretty nice. I mean, they were, it was, mm-hmm. you know, monochrome. They were bright amber, but they were very sort of sharp, and they could switch into like 132 column mode, which was insane and mm-hmm. perfectly legible. You know,
right.
But it was like, you know, me coming from, you know, 3 years earlier, I'd been having an Atari 8-bit that could at best do 40 columns reasonably. And like just being able to have kind of like a nice, really bright high res screen with very crisp text was kind of a different experience compared to mm-hmm. what I was mostly used to.
Yeah, definitely. The terminals were, you know, the point of them was text interaction, and I guess they, you know,
right.
went as far as they could with, given that they didn't actually have bitmapped, you know, memory. They were using, you know, character sets that could be,
right.
They were able to do that with less expense, and, certainly they were easy on the eyes. No mistake.
Mm-hmm. Plus they were amber. That's also nice.
Yep.
Yeah. Most of the ones I saw, sadly, were, I've seen some amber ones, and that's my preference. But the, white really is the, white on black is most of what I've seen, or gray, you know, gray on black for whatever reason.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. There was something, I don't even know how to describe it, but there was sort of like an atmosphere or a psychology or something of being on the VAX cluster from these little terminals, you know, that you're in a different sort of like world space, you know, like this shared space. I forget now what it was. I guess it was Finger or something that was the thing that would tell you like what terminal somebody was logged in from.
Like, well, Finger, you'd have like a, I remember with Finger, you could set up a .plan file. Yep. And it would describe, you know, it would give you, you could give your little blurb. And I remember it was
right.
Like you'd spend all this time in college with your .plan file because it had to be awesome. But it would also tell you like, right, what, you know, where you were and how long you'd been on, I think.
And whether you'd read your mail.
Yeah.
which is insane. I mean, like the idea, like you'd send someone mail and then you could like finger them to see if like they'd seen it yet, you know, it's just terrible, terrible
quite
privacy.
Invasive.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I think we must have talked about that terminal room map for the purposes of what was it called, Assassin?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But yeah, that was actually that was a great. You could see if someone logged in, because we would have the Assassin game we were playing, and this was administered. I was running it for a while for a number of rounds, and it was administered through someone had written some programs that ran on the VAX for keeping track of players and who had killed who and stuff. And then, like, if you assassinated your target, you would report that to who was running the game. So you had to log in somewhere. So people were always logging in somewhere to check status and do things was kind of part of the game. So if you're on your toes, you could find, oh, my target logged in on on this terminal over in this building. Maybe I can run over there and catch him, kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think – so the terminal – my terminal experience was – I think my first the first experience I had was with terminals that were – they're basically IBM 3270 type. So my mother was a systems programmer. And so I would go sometimes with her to work, and then, you know, like I'd get to play like Star Trek or Eliza or something like that, you mm-hmm. know, while she did actual work. But so I had these, you know, like some experience with these 3270 things. And I really would like to at some point get one, although they're big, but, I had, they were used in our university libraries. Mm-hmm. You know, and the ones from the university libraries were green screen. You know, so I would have to look something up and then like write it down on a piece of paper. And
right.
And there's no. It's possible that later on there was a time when I would be able to like take a photo of it with my phone. You know, but yeah. So these. So I really do like them though, and there's a color version, IBM 3279, I guess, mm-hmm. 3290. Maybe that's the, I'm not actually sure. Yeah, 3279, I think, is the color one. But it has this great IBM look to it, with the little, you know, power switch on the side. And, mm-hmm. So they're huge though.
Right.
So, but I would like to get one of these at some point. That's sort of what I think of as a terminal. And I still use these, actually. Not the physical thing, but the, 3270 interface is still something that I need to work with a fair bit.
Really?
In terms of like, you know, interacting with university systems.
Okay.
So all the like graduation records and advisor records and things like that are on a mainframe that I still have to access with this. So I'm still using 3270 terminals, but
yeah, I remember when I was working at it's been quite a few years, but I was working at the University of Virginia, and yeah, a lot of the medical systems and other, there was a big hospital complex, were mainframe based, IBM mainframe based. And yeah, we had all these 3270 terminals everywhere and terminal emulators on the systems because yeah, that was necessary.
Mm-hmm. There's something pleasing about how they work, you know, just how the mainframe works differently from a BBS where it's sort of like conscious of where fields are on the screen and, you know, I don't know. Yeah, there's something to sort of, and I think part of it might be just the, you know, my own sort of like experiences as a younger kid with these mainframes, but just sort of tabbing around on the screen and having it know when you've typed into a field or somewhere else on the screen. And
yeah, there's actually when I was at UVA, as I mentioned, the coolest terminal, and this was the one that everyone would go for. There was only one sitting there, and it's an IBM. I actually am trying to recall the model. It's 3290.
IBM 3290.
Yeah, and it was a plasma. It used what they used to call, it's the coolest terminal I've ever seen, by far. They called, the technology, they called it in the early days gas plasma. You know, it was actually mm-hmm. plasma like we have today, but it was monochrome. It was amber in color. And it was extremely high resolution. It was split into four logical windows that were 80 by 80 by, you know, 25. I'm not sure if you could regulate the size. And these were like, we had the ability to switch. I think there were like 7 or 8 sessions. I remember some of the mainframe apps, CICS 1 and some of the other, you know, these big enterprise education apps, they were tied in and we could page between them and you could zip around and get the information you needed. And, it was amazing. And so I actually have seen several of them on eBay. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to get this terminal, you know, like I want this thing. But it turns out that in order to drive it, there's a very significant piece of hardware that connects with a very significant cable, a cable that's, I think, thicker than a garden hose. And it runs to this, it runs at great length to this, perhaps if your mainframe is situated distant, to a part, you know, it's plugged into the mainframe and it's a right. display controller. And unless you actually can, you know, electronically emulate an IBM, you know, mainframe of some variety, yeah, you can't use it. Like there's just no way, you know, I've looked into it. Has anyone built a conversion box? But you'd actually have to buy a mainframe to drive this screen. So sadly, I'm not going to be able to, you know, have this coolest terminal, but it was amazing.
Well, Blake, who says you can't own a mainframe?
Yeah. Well, I can think of one person upstairs that is pretty certain that I can't have a mainframe. But you know, right. you're right. There's one can always build a garage out back, and of course, I'd probably end up living in that garage if I went to just save room for a bed. But anyway, I wanted to share that particular memory.
Yeah, I think I have. I did buy at some point like a little. Of course, IBM stuff comes in many sizes, but I bought a little mini cluster controller at one point, specifically because I kind of wanted to. It's kind of complex, and I think I probably even talked about it before. But now I've forgotten the name of it. But there's Apple Line, I think is the name of it. It's a very kind of rare. Terminal connector that you can use for, I think the Lisa, and I think you can actually connect an Apple III to it as well, so that you can use them to serve as like 3270 type terminals for an actual mainframe. Hmm. So, and you know, the Apple Line is this, there's like very few of them. I don't know why. I think basically they were maybe leased out to people or something. So they always got returned. Anyway, and it's sort of a nondescript box, which actually is just turns out to be like an Apple rebranding of something else. So it's not even all that exciting. But nevertheless, I was excited up until I learned that, you know, that I had this rare thing. I mean, I do have this rare thing, but it's just that you can get that same thing under a different brand.
Okay.
Losing track of all the names now. Mm-hmm. But it's the obvious, like, 3270 terminal controller people. But anyway, so I bought the little intermediate IBM box so that I could plug the Apple Line into it. And then I was hoping I could then plug it into something like, you know, SimH running on a Raspberry Pi or something. Right. So that it would be, you know, like the mainframe itself would be running on this like little modern thing. But anyway, I haven't gotten very far into that project, but I think a small version of the cluster controller that you need.
Oh, cool.
And I will let you know sometime in 2028 when I finally get around to this.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you get that figured out and I can proceed and acquire that terminal, do let me know.
Yeah, the terminals. There was some versions of the Compaq, I think, had a similar kind of plasma display.
Even with the quad screen? Or
oh, no. No,
yeah, I
think it's the same technology.
I know all of
or the similar looking.
The grid case laptops, you know, those early grid made mm-hmm. some laptops that were very rugged. I think they were like black titanium. Right. They used a yellow plasma, gas right. plasma. And I know there were some other, if I'm not mistaken, the Plato system used a 512 by 512 gas plasma display, and the reason was that they, in order to, have very little, small amount of video memory, they could sweep line by line down the screen, and the plasma would stay lit once it had been excited. And so they only had to have, one line worth of video memory, and yet they were rendering to this very high resolution for the day. And I think that was another use of the gas plasma, which they called it, which I'm sure differs in some not insignificant way to, you know, the plasma television sets that we, well, that we used to have. We don't have those anymore. They're gone. But yeah, interesting.
For some reason, I thought the Play-Doh was a vector graphics, but I don't know.
No, yeah, I'm pretty. I recall it being 512 by 512 also, like this strange square display.
Mm. Yeah, I couldn't. I remember, and I read, you know, the what is it called, the warm or orange
on the orange glow.
Glow, yeah. I couldn't. I never could understand. It's like, oh, we're building this networked educational system, and by the way, we're going crazy and making a 512 by 512 screen, and you have to buy it in plasma. You know, I thought, why don't you just avoid the expense of this custom proprietary screen? It seems crazy to limit yourself, but that's, I learned that it was because it would stay lit. It's like e-ink in a way, you know, and okay. So that's the only way they could do it, because memory was so, you know, it's insane to think, when to hear these cases of how people had to work around the expense and you know, therefore scarcity of RAM, you know, right, in the past. So yeah.
So was it, Blake, was the 3290 the one that you were trying to remember?
No, there's a, and I'll mention it later on if I come across it. I'm not getting much feedback from the IRC folks in this channel, but yeah, it was one of these, and I'll do a search. It's one of these, it's really, you know, clean. I think you might have the ability to close up the keyboard on the screen, but it's probably not the one you're thinking about that you see all the time that does that. And yeah, so I'll see. But no, that's not the one. I might actually buy the one that I can't remember. Well before the 30, the IBM 3290. 3290
is right. It? Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah, there was some Lear Siegler maybe, something like that. There's some very nice looking terminals out there. I almost feel like I shouldn't even talk about them, just because, you know, there's a bunch of people who know a lot about terminals out there listening, I'm sure, and frowning at their podcast player as I speak.
Yes.
Yeah, I think the thing that really got me about this, again, I, you know, on IRC, I spend time, and there's one person who has a number of these terminals lying around in different states of decent repair, and they have a friend who has a hobby of inserting new CRTs of either amber, white, or green into them, depending on what your preference is. And so basically that sounds, you know, that's the kind of thing that makes me just leap for my wallet, and eventually I'll get there. But yeah, I lost touch for a little bit. We've had a little commotion here the past few months. Yeah.
I was right, though. Lear Siegler is the name that I was trying to remember. They have these sort of like nice little kind of rounded terminals. I always whenever I see them on, you know, my eBay searches, I always think about maybe someday I'll get one.
And Paul, in fact, it is the Lear Siegler terminal that I was lusting after. That's the one. You've reminded me. Looking at the pictures, that is indeed the one that I have a source, and then also an alternate source for your choice of color CRTs. Yep. So for better or for worse, I think you've the ADM3A. I think it was their ADM3A model. Yep. Well, thank you for that. My wife thanks you as well.
Great.
We'll have the bedside terminal soon, and you know, it'll be great.
Yeah, they are. There's something just very pleasing about all the sort of, like, I don't know, the curves of them. It's like they're made out of clay or something.
It has a particular compactness and proportionality that many come close to, but somehow this seems to have been the perfect fit for all of the parts. And I guess I was remembering incorrectly about the keyboard folding up, but there's no question now that I see the model number, the ADM3A, that is the one. So
they are always tempting whenever I see them. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll be chatting to one another on our, you know, bedside ADM3As right. Before long.
Excellent. Okay, so I guess we can move on from that to there's a bit of listener feedback, which again is kind of, you know, just more people pointing out news items. But So we got a message from Virtual Colossus on Twitter, and I'm not sure who the person is behind that. Also, apparently there's a thunderstorm here, so there might be actually thunder as well. Hopefully if the lightning won't take up my power. So the tweet from Virtual Colossus said that thanked us for mentioning the website, and apparently there is a 3D version being constructed where you can fully interact with it. So, like the one, if you looked at the link from last time, it was a sort of a 2D panel with all the different devices, and I remember I had accidentally triggered the printer and then couldn't get it to stop making noise in my ear. But apparently there will be a 3D one that we can interact with soon. It looks pretty impressive from the rendering, at least, that we had tweeted at us. But so, everybody look forward to that. And then I guess there's a couple of things. There's an eBay link. Should I mention that? Maybe I will indeed do that. So there's an Intel 8080 in-circuit emulator system, which is, I think it's an 8080 development system that they sent out when these chips were new. And it has like it's basically a computer around this chip, and it has 2 8-inch drives and a keyboard, and it's all sort of like almost like 1950s blue.
Mm-hmm.
And so these things, I don't know very much. Do you guys know much about these things, these development systems?
I don't, actually. Nothing. That is 1950s blue, but I don't know much beyond that.
Yeah, because I think they're not exactly, they're sort of like computers, but not exactly. I mean, you know, it's like they are computers, but they only went to the people who were developing for the chip, right? So like there's no market for VisiCalc on them. This particular one is 900 pounds. Like, the cost is 900 great. How do you say that? GBP? Great British pounds?
Yeah, I guess. I always just think GBP in my mind. Pounds.
Yeah. Approximately 1,176 US dollars, if that is more meaningful to you than
pounds. What's the shipping, I wonder?
The shipping?
To...
Well, this particular thing is not varies. Does not claim to ship to me.
No, it's in the UK. Yeah.
Anyway, so Charlie on Twitter pointed this out and wished for the funds to be able to do it.
That would be if you were to ship it across the ocean. I think that would be quite a charge.
It looks heavy,
and it looks easily damaged. I wonder. Maybe a local pickup.
Yeah, it's in Rickmansworth, UK. So if you know where Rickmansworth is. If you are near Rickmansworth and have 900 spare pounds, then I'm sure it would be fun to play with, but it really does seem like the kind of thing that you play with. It's not the kind of thing that you run stuff on. Mm-hmm. So anyway, thanks Charlie for that. I think the last bit of feedback I was going to mention was Spectron on Twitter mentioned the second run of the Kickstarter for the ZX Spectrum Next. And look at that. The number is moving as I'm looking at it. So apparently somebody backed it just as I was opening the page. But it's had a $327,000 goal, and it is at $1.6 million at this point. It has blasted way past the goal, 17 days to go.
I'm gonna guess the moving was a little JavaScript excitement trickery, but I'll leave that uninvestigated.
Yeah.
Being a web developer.
Hey, we actually have some commentary in the live stream chat about what we're talking about here.
Oh, okay. About the development kit.
Yeah, both about this Intel MDS and about the ADM3A.
Huh? Nice. Uh-huh.
Interesting.
So you want to read it?
Sure.
Just want to leave this
well, so an, so Andy Collins wrote in that both he said the ADM3A was the go-to emulation for CPM80 systems, if he remembers correctly, and he used the Intel MDS in 1982 to blow EEPROMs for his Z80 system. He says it was very big and very clunky.
Yeah.
But he's always had a soft spot for them, but they're pricey. And Sorcerer Stan says he used one of those in his first real job for debugging.
It's interesting to think about, you know, like, I was never in the industry. I was always, you know, outside the industry. But it is interesting to see these fairly large-scale things that were used to develop for the chips before there was a thing to buy.
Right.
Now, on the Kickstarter, the ZX Spectrum Next, so this is, I think we must have talked about it in the first round of Kickstarter.
I think so. I think we did.
And I think somebody did an unboxing and stuff like that. He's like, but it's basically sort of like a modernization of the ZX Spectrum. So it has a bunch of kind of like modern specifications. So it can run at 3.5 megahertz, 7 megahertz, 14 or 28 megahertz turbo modes. It has a megabyte of RAM, can be expandable to 2, and has like high resolution modes of up to 640 by 256, and it can also output to like regular like modern displays of HDMI and so forth. There's a unaccelerated and accelerated version, and through the Kickstarter you can get either one. And I think I believe the unaccelerated one is £300, and the accelerated one is more. Oh, interesting. I assumed it was much more, but it apparently is only £25 more.
Go for the accelerated.
Yeah. I wonder why you would get the decelerated one.
Right.
But anyway, so, you know, whatever that is, £325 comes out to about $426. And this is, I think, a little bit more expensive than the first one, because one of the things they mentioned in the description was that they didn't take into account the tax. on the first one, and lost a boatload.
Oh no!
On the first one, so this one is priced a little bit. This one, I mean, they're not making money on it, but they are at least breaking even on the tax that they were not before.
Okay.
So, and it looks like it's, you know, I mean, it's long since funded.
Right.
So, I'm kind of interested in this. It's a little bit above the price point of my interest, I think, but.
Yeah, same for me. It's kind of like my interest in the Spectrum is not that high. But I think, I mean, the device, I actually really like the design. It looks really sleek and cool. The keyboard looks like it's really nice compared to what you think of a Spectrum keyboard being. Like, I think it looks pretty sweet, actually. But it's just like, I've never even touched one of the original machines. Like, I've never played the games. I have no nostalgia for it in particular, but I think it's a cool effort.
Right. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge number of people who do have that nostalgia and would identify with this. But yeah, it's the same with me. I think I talked about this. I just fairly recently got a Spectrum, you know, like an actual Spectrum, but I haven't even tried it out. I mean, like I've been assembling the power for it, and I need to figure out if I can plug it into something that I can see. So, because the problem with the Spectrum is it has I think there are other ones that are like this too, but it's kind of like, it has only a TV out.
Hmm.
So it'll send a channel 3 or channel 4. And I have to do there's a fairly easy modification you could do inside that will take the composite signal pre-modulation.
Okay.
But I have to do it. I have to open it up and, you know, cut a wire. And I think you can do it without soldering if you believe that you can wrap something tightly enough that it'll keep contact.
Reading, I had no experience with the ZX Spectrum, but with Retro Computing Magazine, which I've been reading for, you know, 15 years or so, you know, they covered extensively. So I got to liking what I saw and I, you know, watching some demo scene items on YouTube. So quite a while ago, I picked up apparently it's not the most common unit. It's this ZX Spectrum 128K, plus, maybe not plus. It has the Yamaha sound chip in it. It had been sitting for like 12 years. And so finally, I got on and figured out, apparently someone indicated it'll take a standard power supply to something like a Sega Master System or something. Like that's not what it is, but they said, get one of these power supplies and it'll work in the US. And, there's a cable that goes from this unit to a SCART. And so it provides RGB out on this unit anyway. It has the DIN connector on the back of the 128. And I actually have a opposite gender SCART cable coming off of my Sony PVM versatile CRT display that I use on my Amiga and with some PAL Atari 8-bit systems. I bought a cable to bridge it, but apparently one provides a ground, one and the other one doesn't expect the ground or something like that. So it didn't work. I took it apart and tried to solder patch the cable. That didn't work. So it's sort of stuck. But I actually also, and I guess this is the point, I had purchased one of these all-in-one cartridges. So it has, like, it gives it, you know, full, all the joystick compatibility. It breaks it out into a digital joystick thing. It came with a SD card that contains every game ever written for the, you know, all this stuff. And it's sort of killing me that I'm sitting here at the house all this time and I can't find a source for this, you know, this halfway cable that I need to mate with my other, you know, SCART input. So, I'm determined not to go down this road and get the one I actually have, you know, geared up for to work, you know, on the system. But I'll let people, that's one of the main things that's been on hold mode for me. And I'll let people know when that comes together. But
yeah, I think when I had just gotten the ZX Spectrum, someone in our comments had warned me about the fact that the power polarity is reversed from normal. So I basically went out and got one of those sort of like universal Radio Shack, you know, things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah. Anyway, I had to go out and get a sort of specific universal power adapter that allowed me to switch the polarity so that I could, you know, not fry the thing.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I do like the design of the Spectrum. Like the original Spectrums are also nice.
Yeah.
With their little colorful corner.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's all of the feedback that I had taken note of. I'm sure there's probably other feedback that I've missed and that we will talk about in the future. But now I can go to the items of interest and news, and Blake has the first of these.
All right, there's a few items I saw that were, they got my interest. There's a game, a Pac-Man clone for the Apple II called, there's Taxman from HAL Labs, H-A-L Labs, and there is also a Super Taxman 2. Had you heard of either of these or both? Either of
these? Oh, yeah. I played both. As I recall, Taxman was a closer clone, and Super Taxman 2 was a little bit more its own thing.
Yes, and I discovered the reason for that. our Taxman 2 is further afield. It's a good game, but it's further afield from the actual Pac-Man. Well, it's a little article from the Apple II Project's website that mentions, goes into some history on it, and it turns out that, you know, it was in 81 that HAL Labs released Taxman, and Taxman can only be controlled by keyboard. If you recall, no joystick on the analog too. It was pretty much a straight clone of the Apple II, and the article actually explains, which, and this surprised me, that Atari, you know, wasn't happy since they held the rights to the original Pac-Man. Well, that doesn't surprise me, but they asked HAL to stop selling it, and the article claims that Atari took Taxman for their own, changed the title, modified it in some ways, and released it as the official Pac-Man for the Apple II platform. I was not aware of that. Is that something you had heard, Paul?
I hadn't. It doesn't conflict with my view of the world necessarily, but I wouldn't have been able to come up with that.
I feel like they have some visual differences, but you know, it could be that that was something that basically happened. At any rate, the thing that interested me and also drove the article author to put this out there is that they created Super Taxman 2 and made it a bit different than Pac-Man to stay away from Atari's, you know, getting in their face. And it might have actually better gameplay. You know, it's a lot. It's rather different. The mazes look different. They're not ghosts anymore. But the developers were annoyed. You remember Taxman would only use a keyboard. They didn't like the slow speed of the analog stick on the Apple II. And the Apple II, yeah, if you've played a Pac-Man-like game on a PC or a 2 with analog, it's not great. You know, it's not a great the response there, it just takes some time for the stick to travel, and there's like a, you know, the dead zone. And so while they also supported keyboard on Super Taxman 2, they actually built a adapter. It was called the Gizmo adapter. And what it did was it would plug into the, it looks like the motherboard, the DIP chip input of the original Apple II. And of course it was present on all the Apples out to the to the before the 2C, I guess. And it would accept, you know, an Atari-style joystick, and it would work. You know, Super Tex-Man 2 accepted it. It recognized it. And apparently some other games that Hal had written, one Vindicator, which a Robotron clone, apparently, and Gizmo, would also recognize and use it. So you couldn't use the analog stick with Super Tex-Man 2, but you could use this device. And it looks like I found it interesting that the there's a layout in the article, and you can, you know, people could build the device. I'm not sure. I don't think it was actually sold, but it could be built. And I would not be surprised if some other games out there have supported it and were just not aware of it, given that it was out there. But I thought that was an interesting little, you know, side note on the Apple II early game history.
There was another. There's another. Device that would adapt Atari joysticks to, well, maybe there were a few even that would adapt Atari joysticks to the analog Apple II.
There was a device called the Paddle Adapple, but was that, what did that do?
I think that mostly just externalized the port. So it was just so you could either plug in two different inputs and switch between them. Also it would just sit outside the computer, so you wouldn't have to keep like unplugging things from the motherboard.
Okay.
So
I think it's interesting, and it reminds me of, and you know, this fits right in with his personality, but Jeff Minter, who, you know, famously has been developing for the Atari since, you know, I think the original 400 and 800, he created for the a number of games for the Jaguars as it came out way back when. You know, he did some firsts for a number of different platforms after as well. But for the Jaguar, he created Tempest 2000, which is one of his most popular games. And, you know, Tempest is a superb arcade game, in my opinion. And he created a really psychedelic version for the Jaguar, which had some, you know, advanced color capabilities, that sort of thing. And, but, you know, the Jaguar's controller is pretty terrible. It's large and awkward, and there's it's only a digital pad, and, you know, that's not, you don't want to really be playing, in the arcade, there's actually a rotary controller. You know, analog stick would be in between, but digital pad is horrible. So Minter created, he supported the existence of a controller that didn't exist, in the game, an analog controller, and it would read the potentiometer inputs on this line and that line. And if anyone built it, it theoretically would work. And so people, started building it. And I have purchased one. It's a modified Jaguar controller that has the rotary controller, and it makes it, you know, it's a weighted rotary controller. It makes it, you know, just perfect. Like, it feels like it's one of the best game experiences I have at my access in this house. And it's unofficial. So it reminded me of that. And you know, people, when he went on, and not to take this tangent forever, but he went on and built the programmed Tempest 3000 for the very little known Nuon. There's a, right. That kind of was a ROM set for DVD players. I also have one sitting behind me. It had an analog stick, so Tempest 3000 was a lot better than control-wise than 2000. I think 2000 might be a better game, but people were, you know, very sad to understand that apparently he did not, in fact, code in the rotary, non-existent rotary controller for that one. So,
I actually have a Jaguar controller with a rotary dial added on the back.
Oh, on the back. Okay.
Yeah. So there's a guy who does these modifications, and he has a few different varieties of doing it. He also he's done some mods where he replaces the D-pad with a rotary dial. But I found this actually works pretty well, because you can hold it. When I play the game this way, I hold it kind of weird. So the buttons are on the front, and you do use all three red buttons. So you can kind of like hold it like this. But what I often end up doing is I actually do this. So I have the buttons under my three fingers, and I have the knob here. And that actually, in my left hand. And it works pretty well. And he's been with a nice sort of weighted knob. And I've had this for about a year, I think. I haven't played it a ton of times this way, but I've done it, and it's pretty fun. It definitely makes the game much more like it's supposed to be.
Okay.
Compared to pressing left and right in the D-pad.
That's impressive. I have the one, I don't know if it's the same fellow, but the setup I have is where the D-pad itself was replaced.
Right.
Was your D-pad still intact on yours?
It is, and he's put a switch on the bottom, between, but I feel like it doesn't actually work properly. I've been meaning to contact him because I don't think it's quite wired up right.
Okay.
So, well, that's, we're going pretty far afield here, but in the Tempest 2000 game, when you get to certain bonus levels, you're required to use the D-pad to go left, right, up, down. There's these bacon levels because it looks like you're flying flying along a weird strip of bacon. And so I think the idea with this is to be able to switch between the two. But when I've tried to do it, it actually doesn't work. I just kind of fall out of that bonus level. So.
Okay.
But I have
You know what else this reminds me of? No, I'm kidding. I'm not going to. I've got another thing this reminds me of. Let's see how far we can get. Yeah, sorry for the sidebar, but, similar kind of thing. But I'd like to know if anyone is aware of if anyone is aware of the, any other Apple games that support the, that particular, the HAL Labs designed breakout item, please let us know. That would be interesting. I would not be surprised if something did.
Yeah. And the thing I was trying to remember the name of before is the Sirius Joy Port, which was another adapter for Atari joysticks for the Apple II. And that one definitely had a lot more support because all the Sirius games used it, for one thing. And Sirius, they did a lot of influential Apple II games.
That's interesting. The Sirius, they were some really, out there, but high quality games, the Sirius titles, and thinking about having digital control for that is definitely a better experience. I had never heard of this. I never knew that was the case. I kind of want to get one now.
Yeah, they do show up occasionally. But one of the things I was thinking about was conceivably things that worked with the Joyport might also work with the Gizmo.
Could be.
Seems like there's a chance.
Okay, Jack, I guess you have the next thing.
Yeah, I noticed a new Netflix series called High Score that popped up very recently. I think I've watched one episode a few days ago. I think it only came out a couple days ago.
Right.
There are, six or eight episodes. It's a documentary series about the history of the video game industry, starting with the 70s with, Atari and onward. I've only watched one episode. It was pretty fun to watch. Rebecca Heineman is in there talking about how she got started, before programming, got started playing video games, entering a Space Invaders contest, entering the California semifinals, and then winning that and going on to New York City to play and that sort of thing. And they talked to these guys. I don't remember the names. These guys who were at MIT who they started a little side business installing arcade games and then collecting the money out of those. And then they were like, oh, Missile Command is great. We got a bunch of these, but people are getting better at playing the game, so we get less money because they play longer per quarter. Let's hack this. Let's make a better version of Missile Command to run on this hardware. And so they made a mod kit that they would sell to other owners of Missile Command games. And Atari came down on them pretty hard and was suing them for $5 million and stuff. But they eventually came to a settlement agreement, though. The settlement agreement was, okay, you guys stop doing this and come work for us at Atari instead. And you can't do this for any other games that you don't have permission for. But at the time, they already had a major Pac-Man adaptation going. And they contacted, I think it was Namco, who owned the Pac-Man rights in the U.S., and they didn't really release all the details of their settlement with Atari, but they said, look, we have this thing, and we've already defeated Atari at their attempt to stop us, so you just need to go along with this and give us permission to do this mod for your game, too. And they weren't asking for money for it, just saying we want to be able to put this out there. And they eventually and they agree to this, but eventually, that's what became Ms. Pac-Man. Actually,
yeah.
I thought I didn't know the full story. I thought they were talking about Pac-Man Plus because that was a hack that I remember. You could get a modification for the Pac-Man arcade game that was called Pac-Man Plus that would it would turn the maze invisible and stuff and do just to make it more difficult. I thought that's where it was leading, but then turned out to be Ms. Pac-Man instead. But they also mentioned in here Jerry Lawson, who we've mentioned now and then, I think. He was really the creator of the mechanism for interchangeable ROM cartridges in video games. Mm-hmm. So he created the mechanism for the Fairchild Channel F, which was the first one that came out before the Atari VCS. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of nice. He passed away in 2011, but they talked to a couple of his kids and one of his grandkids and stuff, sort of looking through some of his photos and things like that.
So this is more – sounds clearly – I'd never heard of this, actually. This is more – it's documentary style, I guess.
It's documentary style. It's very – it's quite entertaining, infotainment. And there are some points – I don't go through – there were some points that in watching the first episode, I was like – really, you guys? I don't think your analysis here is quite correct. But it's entertaining, and it's more about just sort of exploring some things and showing some things, and it was fine. They talked to what's his name? The guy who created Adventure and then Indiana Jones and then E.T. The guy who's sometimes described as the guy who caused the video game crash because the E.T. game was so terrible. Which they go into a bit, but it's like that's not really what caused the video game crash. And they talk about the video game crash of 83, but they didn't really get into why it really happened. Yeah. So it's sort of hit or miss. But it was nice that they actually talked to some of the people who are still alive who were involved in that sort of thing. So it's
okay.
Yeah. It's entertaining
with Netflix money.
I wondered if it was coming in a Halt and Catch Fire type format, but no, it sounds like not.
No, it's just documentary style. It has actually very nice, they have a lot of nicely done pixel graphics for sort of their kind of cut scenes and things. It's a nicely produced artifact, if not 100% factually correct all the time.
Is the entire series, I guess, is available right now?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah.
That's how it works nowadays, I guess.
Who else? I think they talked to Nolan Bushnell a bit, and they talked to... They talked to a few different people, so it's sort of fun in that regard. They're interviewing people. Oh yeah, they interviewed a couple of Japanese creators. One who worked on Pac-Man, one who worked on Space Invaders.
Did they talk to Leonard Tramiel?
They did not. They didn't get that far anyway. So this kind of goes up through 1983 or 84. Okay. So
yeah,
and I don't know how much is going to get into home computers at all. So far, there was no mention of that. They were talking primarily about arcade games and the Atari 2600. And you saw, I think they showed a bit of an Intellivision ad and that kind of thing. So it's
interesting.
I think I don't know. So I don't know where it's going to lead to in episode two. I guess they'll get into the sort of Nintendo NES era, that kind of thing.
Well, Nintendo's sneaking in with that robot, so it's not actually a video game machine. Their clever move with the little Nintendo robot thing. I'd be curious to hear how they cover that. That's nifty. I'll watch it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. It's entertaining. Worth watching, I think. I've enjoyed it so far.
Excellent. Yeah, it's definitely on my list.
My daughter will be pretty excited to hear that that's out now. She'll enjoy watching that with me. He says with an enormity of sarcasm.
Yes.
Anyway. Yeah.
So, let's see. I have the next thing. And it is, this is a fairly short little thing. This was actually sent to us as feedback by Bob. Anyway, it is a Hackaday article about an ESP32 Altair emulator. And so I don't know actually all that much about these things, but the ESP32 is a little system on a chip kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And there was an Altair 8800 emulator for it. It had a connector for a VGA a monitor and a PS2 keyboard so that you could use it as an Altair 8800. And the Hackaday article is writing up basically someone's attempts to try to do away with the need to have a PS2 keyboard and a VGA monitor connected. They just wanted to connect to it with a serial connection. And so the the task was basically to look at the emulator and try to figure out, like, okay, how hard would it be to add the serial? And it turned out, actually, that the serial was even already in place. It's just that it was being used as a card punch reader instead of like a terminal. So basically, what the project just kind of outlines going through and making the change so that the serial can be used to communicate with us, you know, headlessly, basically. And in fact, actually also leaving intact the ability to plug in a PS2 keyboard if you want. So the actual article is called "The ESP32 Altair Emulator Gets Split Personality." And the split personality part is actually about the ability to either plug in a keyboard or not. And there's, you know, some sort of technical stuff about how it's reading sensing the state of a switch on the actual board to know whether it should go into the setup mode or not. But anyway, it's kind of neat. I mean, it's sort of short, but it's kind of cool. And the idea is supposed to be that if you wanted to quickly demo a CPM system to somebody, I think the conceit is that, you know, this is a quick and easier way to do it than running SimH or some emulator or something. I'm not convinced that it's easier to have a piece of physical hardware connected by serial port to anything. But anyway, it's a neat project regardless. So if you were interested in doing that, the emulation options for the Altair 8800 have gotten even a little more advanced than they were recently. Mm-hmm. So,
cool.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay, so shall I move on to the next item?
Sure.
Okay, so the next one is not a a cheerful bit of news, I'm afraid, but another notable person from the past of you know, computing history has sadly passed away, 91 years old, born in 1929, Russell A. Kirsch. He was a computer scientist from Oregon, and he actually worked with one of the first computers as it existed in the country, I believe, the Standards Eastern Automatic Computer, which was the SEAC, and it was one of the first programmable computers in the U.S., and he was tasked with the responsibility of getting it to read in digital information, sort of, you know, basically scanning, you know, images, photographs. And so his team created a device that was, I guess, crude compared to, you know, what we have as far as scanners now today. It's a rotating drum with some photo sensors, photo multipliers, and they would pick up reflections from an image on the drum, and they would interpret them into and store them, the data, as bits into discrete pixels. And so it appears to be the first time that the notion of a discrete digital representation of graphics, which in this case are real world graphics that have been scanned, existed. So he's been, you know, termed by some as the father of the pixel, which is an interesting, you know, it's sort of an interesting piece of the history of how we got from no graphics to where we are today. Wired did an interview with him in 2010, and they spoke to him about a particular thing that he always regretted, was the fact that pixels remained square, and they're always, everything was a square grid of pixels, and he created some sort of organic orientations of not squares, but different organic shapes that can be rotated, triangles, along with squares and rectangles, to better render an image instead of, you know, just with basic pixels. It seems, looking closely at it, it seems like this is done using sort of smaller square pixels, but I'm not understanding mathematically. I think it was more in the mathematical realm that he's talking, as far as how it would have to be implemented on a pixel-based system. Of course, that would have to use pixels. So it's interesting. But I was not familiar with the fellow, and found it, the article interesting to read from Digital Photography Review. And yeah, so I thought I'd mention that. I'm not sure how many out there have great familiarity with the gentleman.
Yeah, I had not heard of him until I saw this news pop up that he had died.
Yeah.
Unaware of his work.
Yeah, me too. So you learned something new, and sadly he's passed on, but left a contribution, certainly.
And Jack, you have another thing.
Yeah, I have one more thing. So My friend Edward Patel sent me this link. This is not totally new, but I don't think we talked about it. So this is called the C-74 project. Mm-hmm. And it's subtitled the C-74-6502 CPU, a homemade TTL 6502. So we've talked before about things like the Monster 6502, the huge board with all the components laid out. This is made in a slightly different way with TTL chips, and it will run at up to 20 megahertz. So it will run faster than a 6502 ever ran back in the day. Mm-hmm. And somebody worked on this for a couple of years, and it's kind of a little series of boards that can either be sort of cross-wired over to each other in a couple of different ways, including as a sort of little stack. And they have some different pictures and videos. And towards the end, they actually show that they connected this thing up to a VIC-20 and actually ran it that way, and it works just fine. So it's pretty neat. So they've actually made a 6502 out of a little bits and launched it on a VIC-20. So, I mean, it should be plug-in compatible with that, with any 6502 machine, actually. Mm-hmm. They just haven't tried it with more than that, I think. But pretty neat. And there's plenty of photos and lots of detail about this. And there are schematics and all sorts of things. So, pretty fun.
That's
fun and interesting project. And more sort of like practical and useful than the Monster 6502, in a way, I guess. This will actually run at full speed and more. So
yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Is that I think the Monster runs like half a megahertz or something like that.
It runs less than what we ever needed. Whereas this, you can actually once you do it, you can actually just plug it right in 6502 slot. So pretty neat. I don't know why we never heard of this before. At least I never saw this. The last date on this is from 2017 December. But Okay. I'm scrolling farther than I've scrolled before. They actually did the C64 also, so it apparently required a bit more work. But looks like they got it working. So,
is this something that you can build yourself or order or is this just sort of an interesting project that you get to?
I'm not really sure.
Read about.
So apparently it's been on Hackaday and things. Just I guess none of us saw it. If I scroll back up to the top, maybe I can see. I don't really know if they have sort of all the details so you can actually build it yourself or not. I mean, there's like a schematic, but...
Logic schematic.
Yeah.
But it's cool that it works.
And all project files.
And to be honest, there's no way I was going to build it myself. It's conceivable that I could have bought one built, but...
It does seem like they have a lot of documentation. Yeah, it seems like they have what you probably need. So... In case you change your mind, Paul, you could build it.
Okay. I have so many things yet to build.
Anyway, I just thought it was pretty neat because it's still building 6502 out of parts, but in a much more compact and useful form.
And, Blake, you have...
Okay, and then I guess the last item I have is something that it's an Amiga program that was written this year, a short audio program, and I'll... it's uploaded to the AmiNet.
AmiNet? That's how you would pronounce that?
Well, AmiNet.
That's not how I would have pronounced it.
I guess AmiNet.
Yeah, I mean, I never thought about it very much, but... Yeah.
I think in my head I say AmiNet.
I think
now I don't know what I say. I sound like I've lost my mind. AmiNet. Anyway, so the page on AmiNet actually has not a great deal of information. It explains it is a module player, and modules are a certain type of sound. It's basically kind of like a MIDI file that contains digital samples of the instruments that are played in service of faithfully reproducing that file. They're put together in audio trackers. This really started on the Amiga, and it spread from there to DOS and other systems, Atari ST, and so modules and then other or mod files, as they're referred to, and other formats that sprang from them form a big portion of the demo scene. As far as, all the audio that goes along with demos, but it's also its own scene. People, download, there's hundreds of thousands of mods that have been written for different systems and can be played if you have the right player. At any rate, this is a module player written this year that runs on 68,000 base Amigas, even as basic as the original 68,000 chip itself. But what's interesting is, well, there's several things. It's 23K in size. And what it does is it actually will utilize any network stack that you have on an Amiga. And there are ways to network basic Amigas. There is the most basic method is to attach a device called a flip box to the parallel port, and any Amiga can basically it goes to Ethernet, or maybe they go to Wi-Fi now, but at any rate, it connects and you have a slow connection, and you can, you know, applications that access one of the three or four standard TCP/IP stacks you can install can communicate on the network. So I have an Amiga 2000 that happens to have an Ethernet card in it, and it's running some software called AMI TCP, and it provides a standard latch point for this app and other apps, browsers, that kind of thing to attach to. And there are mod archives out there in different places, and some you can access and play through your browser. But he's kind of handpicked a number of collections and brought them in. And basically you start it up and it begins playing. It pulls down a random mod file, plays it on your actual hardware Amiga. Of course, it'll run an emulation. You can like it, unlike it. There's actually a big part of it is there's half the screen is a IRC-like chat so that anyone else that's running this app, you can talk to them. You see they're present in the chat. You can recommend a song back and forth. It actually even has there's a file tree that's part of this as well. On that server, there are certain utilities and games that are the author of the system is Pavel Nowak is involved in a group of developers that on the Amiga are creating a number of games for 68K Amigas, and there's a Kickstarter for all of their work. So I think that's basically the games you're seeing and some core utilities. But if you click, you can actually have the executables run right then, or you can save them and run them later. So it's kind of crazy. In 23K, you've got like a file sharing system, an IRC chat, and a social music, sharing system. You can, customize the look of the thing. It has a screen mode. It renders everything on a screen. There's also a Windows desktop mode, if you want to run it alongside your other applications on the Amiga desktop. So I was just impressed by the fact that it's, again, 23K. It's written entirely in assembly language. And there's a demo video that we can link to that I actually put together as far as, just kind of taking it through its paces and, seeing what happens in the different display windows. It shows the tracks that are, or the instrument scroll of the notes and what's happening. And you can see it loading other items. But I was quite impressed. I always look for new ways to use a, one of their legacy machines in kind of a modern way. And here I can turn this on and just let it run. And I've got an Amiga 2000 doing, playing some music. I like mod files. I've got a few hundred locally that I'll play on different systems. And it's pretty impressive. And I did a little write-up on the Byte Seller because there was so little written about it out there on a web page. There's a forum link that we'll also include where the development of the system is discussed. But I was quite impressed, and I think it's got me really excited, and I've run it every day. I discovered it about a week ago, and it's been running for most hours of the workday behind me. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Cool.
It's pretty wild. Mm-hmm.
That does look like fun. I don't have an Amiga at all, but I might. This seems interesting enough to maybe grab an emulator and try it out.
It seems like, even if you're into, if you're into mods, you probably have, not necessarily Amiga, but you've got something and you're probably playing them. But it almost like, if I didn't have an Amiga, I could see picking up a cheap system, putting a little parallel port box on it for cheap, and then just, having fun with this sitting over on the shelf, if no other use. impressive.
Cool. Yeah, though I actually don't think of Amigas as being like super cheap and easily available, you know, not like Commodore 64s.
yeah. I mean, I guess it did. You're right. And there's different models. I mean, I guess when I'm looking through, you know, for eBay finds, like I'll see a pretty beat up, you know, like old Amiga 500 that is, you know, as yellow as a banana, you know, and you could really use that, you know, but right. If you wanted to go, you know, if you wanted to do a clean setup for the actual use. Yeah. But it's so motivating to me what this guy's put together that, you know, it's definitely a really big use case for an Amiga. And, you know, as you know, like that's why I'm so happy about BBSing. It's there. This is a some way that I can get around and use all of these machines. You turn them on, there's an excuse, and here's an excuse to never turn off the Amiga. So, But yes, it did help that I have several Amigas in this room. that does help. The entry barrier is a little bit lower, but yeah, run an emulator. You know, watch it on the emulator for free.
Yeah, cool.
And I do think that, if I'm not mistaken, mods kind of originated with Amiga, right? I mean, like that's essentially the native platform.
I think it was, and I'm not going to say that. I think it was Karsten Obarski. I'm not. Forgive me, Amiga people, if I picked the wrong individual. But yeah, this Amiga, their Soundtracker application, the original Soundtracker application from Europe was it laid down the ability to create. You know, songs, you'd create the, you know, it had very MIDI-like in, you know, as far as there's different codes that, you know, happen in these 64 item kind of sheet music panels and you can include the music. And then one of the options, and this wasn't the point, but one of the options was to save it off. Like instead of having your instrument directory and your song sheet directory, you could save it as a module, you know, which was very space inefficient, but then you could hand it around. And yes, it sprang from there. And then on the PC, you know, it had a lot more horsepower and you could add a great many, you know, like the audio cards. There were cards that had, you know, 32 audio, you know, hardware channels. And so these other formats, S3M and Tua Tracker, Fast Tracker, sprang up. And so it kind of took off from there. They were, you know, more capable than the Amiga if you spent some money and, you know, had some hardware there. So, but yeah, it definitely started with the Amiga.
Yeah, I know I played a little bit with, I think it was called Player Pro on the Mac, which is a tracker. But I didn't do it. Did not do much writing of mods, but I did just played with them a little bit. Jack, you wrote some, didn't you?
Yeah, I did some back in the early 90s, my Amiga days. Nice. I remember playing with some of these. The one that I remember using most, the software I used most was, there was something called Med, and then there's something called Octamed, which is the 8-channel version. So eight they channel. Would just sort of, you know, I guess basically using the four actual hardware channels, flipping them between eight virtual channels. Yeah. Give you a little more flexibility, but at reduced sound quality. But it worked fine. It was fun. I didn't do anything that was super advanced, and I don't have any of that stuff left, unfortunately. But it was fun to play with. I really enjoyed that technology. It was neat because you could have little samples that would trigger in every note and everything, and it was a neat thing.
Yeah, and I remember Octamed was. Back in the heyday of the Amiga was kind of the high point because, yeah, it was reduced quality, but it was a really good tracker. And
yeah.
You had the eight, you know, you had the ability to use, you know, eight different voices. And the fact that, again, you know, the Amiga was revolutionary in so many ways. And one of the ways is, you know, you could play back these, you know, four hardware channels of digitized audio without any CPU impact. So that's right. Why the demo scene was able to pick it up. You could have these deep, full audio parties going on, which the only processing that had to happen is basically scrolling a text file. The CPU is spitting out text file information to the audio hardware, which is basically for free, and while it's doing its other graphic rendering. So yeah, it's a really cool scene that is still, you know, out there.
Yep.
And I think that's about all I have as far as items of interest this episode.
All right. And that, I think, is the end of the items of interest and news. And now a word from our sponsor.
Early morning, semi-detached, Highgate, London. Industrial consultant Rex Malik feels the business world's pulse from his bedside. Stock prices and market trends are available to him through Europe's first home computer terminal. This terminal is linked to a giant brain 10 miles away in the heart of London. It's one of two Malik has installed for experimental purposes, because he wants to know if they can run his life and his home for him. They're simple to operate, and experts predict that in 20 years' time, all new houses will be built with special computer points, and the terminals will be cheaper to rent than today's telephones. There's no complicated language to master before he can understand what the computer's saying. The unseen brain sends its messages in good old-fashioned English. Every day, the computer sends Rex Malik a daily reminder of where he should be, for he's stored his day-to-day diary with the brain. The computer can handle a year's shopping list for the home, final demands, and the exact state of Malik's bank balance. It could become a sort of robot housekeeper crossed with a private secretary. But so far, the Malik family isn't quite sure exactly how best to use it. But there's one member of the household who has no doubt of the advantages a computer in the home offers. He's Nicholas Malik, aged 4. Every afternoon, he spends time on the terminal. Mr. Malik says that it's helped Nicholas to read and count. Within 3 days of starting, Nicholas was able to send simple requests to the computer and read the answers as they came back.
P? Now where's the E? You had it just now.
That one?
Yep, push that one. Let's see if you've done it right. Press my return button.
That one?
No, that button. You know the return
that
button.
One?
Yes. To add it all up. That's the adding up button.
It's an expensive way to do sums, at least £30 per week a terminal. But Rex Malik sees a future world where children could be virtually educated by computer, where every home will have its own terminal plugged into a central brain. And from the brain will come not only school lessons. He sees his son growing up in a world where eventually his very thoughts could be stored and perhaps assessed for his future use.
No, no. Now you know where the P is on that keyboard. Come down a bit.
And we're back. The next item is the host's retro computing gift idea. And this fortnight, it is going to be Sea Jump, a ski and snowboard race. I feel like we've had a number of these kinds of things before, but this is basically a computer programming board game. So it's to help children learn basics of programming languages such as C, C++, and Java. I can't tell if it's fun. It sort of looks less fun than some of the other ones we've seen, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it has a little, you know, comes with a little, I think of them as like little sorry people, but they're little like, you know, these little markers
tokens.
Of
markers.
Yeah. A board with sort of like loop structures on it and things, and at least one die to roll. It's apparently a little programming teaching game. 2 to 4 players, ages 11 and up. $25 US.
$50 worldwide, including free shipping and handling.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like it's sort of an independent effort.
Yeah.
It appears.
Yep.
But
could be something.
It'd be interesting to see.
Could be something. Hey Paul, this reminds me. Did you ever play that Load Runner arcade or that Load Runner board game at Kansas Fest?
I did not.
No.
I don't think. Did I?
I never heard from anyone. I remember that it was going to happen, but I never heard from anyone who played it.
I believe that Carrington may have.
Okay.
Reports were that it was terrible.
What? That's incredible.
But, yeah. Anyway.
All right.
Next year, maybe.
Next year. Cool.
I feel like we should have had more to say about that, but I can't think of anything more to say about that. So
that's just how that's just the level of excitement we have about it. It's exactly that and
right.
No more.
So if anyone gets Sea Jump and plays it with their children, let us know how it went.
Yep.
But okay, so now once that is done, we will turn to our eBay auctions. And Blake, you have the first set.
Okay. eBay auctions. Well, this the first item I think matches in rather well. It's in this. I'll just go through quickly. Earlier, Jack mentioned the Netflix documentary series, which is, what was the name of that, Jack?
It's called High Score.
And they talked to the creator of the Fairchild Channel F. And I actually, in my list, before I knew you were going to talk about that, was a Fairchild entertainment system, the Channel F, on eBay, which I don't personally see many of these on eBay. It's buy it now at $1.99, which actually seems like a pretty good price for this. If it actually works, it is museum condition. Does that strike you folks as a good deal or?
Don't really know. I've seen the Swedish version of this for somewhat less than that at a couple of events I've been at, but who knows? I don't really know. Yeah, yeah. They're not super common. So
yeah,
it's not. I don't know either. I would say that feels to me like it's not a deal, but it's not.
Okay. It's not ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I respect the history of it as the, you know, and the inventor as the first, you know, cartridge-based system. And I think didn't it evolve into the Bally Astrocade or something? Am I remembering incorrectly on that?
I don't know.
At the next iteration?
I don't think that's the case, okay. But I'm not sure.
Okay. Yeah. But anyway, I just because, you know, I don't see too many of these, right. And I know it has, there's some history attached to it. I was pointing that one out. Another item I've got is a...
this thing's hilarious.
Yeah, this is a... You know, we're talking about terminals, and while I was running through looking at various eBay auction items, I ran across a very unique-looking, very space-age, futuristic-looking... It almost has a kitchen, wanting to be in a kitchen look. It's a CRT sitting on a rotating pedestal that has a base plate... that extends beyond the right of the CRT and then rises up holding two vertically oriented half height 5 1/4 inch drives. It's certainly a distinctive look. I've never seen this before. It's a NEC PC-M580 and it's a Teletext terminal, which is, you know, Teletext is the sort of graphic, terminal information system, that was, happened early in the early 80s, I think. I don't know if it evolved into, but it's similar technology visually to, now I can't recall the name of the Prodigy, I think, had a similar sort of graphical, vector based. Anyway, Teletext terminal. So it's not exactly the same sort of, you know, text terminal that we'd been talking about, but it had such a unique look that I thought I would put it up. It's actually going at the high price of $4,250. I'm not sure how collectible it is. The disk drives, apparently it can be used for word processing as well. There may be other applications and for designing Teletext, content pages. So it has, there is some interaction. But okay. Anyway, it had a unique look that I thought I'd share.
We have seen this before in... Part of what I remember about it is that Foon Turing, who I think I've mentioned before, is has a very interesting Twitter account to follow.
Tweeted,
but he'd found this auction, some time ago, a couple months ago probably, and sort of did a bunch of digging about like what kind of machine this was and that sort of thing, and grabbed a bunch of the photos and. But it turned out that he grabbed them at just the right time, because one thing that you will not appreciate, I think, unless you're actually watching our stream at the moment, but this auction has since been just completely watermarked to death. I mean, it's like under this like fog of watermarks of the seller.
Yeah.
Because I guess it's just like these are kind of rare photos or whatever. So, but if you go to the... Foon Turing's account, Twitter feed, which is it's at Foon, F-O-O-N-E, then he had a bunch of these photos prior to that, but prior to the terrible watermarking incident.
Yeah, when I was digging into this, I saw his posts and thought, wow, those pictures sure look similar, but without that ridiculous rainstorm of watermarks. Yeah, so yeah. I guess that's what happened. Anyway, interesting unit.
It's a really funky design. It's like strange, L-shaped with monitor in the space where there is not an L.
Yeah.
Right.
Like a capital L that fell down to its left and someone dropped a CRT on its flat part. Effectively, kind of gives you the picture. But
so you should, like, one hopes that there's a Tetris game written for this.
At any rate, I'll move on to my last. And there's nothing highly unusual about this. It's a vintage Apple IIgs computer maxed out. It's just that it is a particularly maxed out Apple IIgs computer. It's, in my eye anyway, someone selling a GS fitted with the PC transporter card, with a 5 1/4-inch drive, 3 1/2-inch drive, math coprocessor. He's got a transwarp accelerator running at 14 megahertz. He has a CPM card, so you can run CPM, various other RAM expansions. It's been recapped. It has the best version, key switch-wise, of the GS keyboard, no yellowing, and he points out that it can boot 5 operating systems, ProtoS-DOS, GSOS, CPM, DOS 3.3, and has a flash card. So it seemed like a nice, I guess there's no hard drive, it occurs to me, at the end of all this.
It has the turbo drive.
Oh, the drive turbo, yes, you're right. Okay, that was the thing that I was, the flash card, I guess, speaks to that. And it's priced at $1,889, which is expensive, but I think, Transwarp Accelerator is a good number of $100, and, it's all together, it's on the, I can't say that it's a, terribly unfair price. If somebody wanted to pick up a very good condition, basically, this is as far as you can take it system.
If you just kind of want to get something that works and not have to mess around trying to accumulate all the pieces, this is a way to do it. The CPM card that they have is the PCPI Apple card, Apple card, which is one of the best ones that you can have too. I mean, like, it's a highly thought of CPM card.
Interesting. Yeah, I see it runs at 6 megahertz, where I think most ran at 4, if I'm not mistaken. Interesting. It looks like it's in very, very good condition. And you would literally set this on your desk, and there's nothing else you could do with this. You cannot add anything else to it. It's completely maxed out. So,
Does it not have a top lid? All the photos do not show a top lid.
I think it must. It's no yellowing, and talks about the quality. But yes, I would have also included the top lid in at least one of the photographs. I'm assuming if it doesn't have a top lid, that does change the equation a bit. But it doesn't say it doesn't have a top lid.
Oh, I see who this is. Yeah, this is
monitor.
This is shipping out of Canada. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah,
the seller is somebody who knows what they're doing. I mean, they sell a lot of Apple stuff and so forth.
Okay. It looks like he's got a number of auctions there. But, free shipping, for me anyway, to the U.S. out of Canada. But it seemed like a nice collection. My GS took me many years to not get this far, and a lot of hours and a lot of money. And I'm happy with it. It's pretty good, but it's not this capable. So, But anyway, that's it for me on the eBay.
Cool.
Okay. So I have a number, not as high a number as often, which is probably fine since Jack is in his hot apartment as the clock ticks by. So I just, just sort of looking around, I saw the first one I have here is, it's an Apple basic programming manual, but it's basically a knockoff. It's a Korean reprint. So it says, if you can sort of read it at the top, it says Apple II in Korean, computer textbook, basic programming manual. But then inside, it's basically just it's just a duplicated version of the Apple manual.
Oh, so really just the cover is in Korean.
Yeah. No, inside it's just a copy of the manual inside. Oh, wow. I have come across this before. I think there's sort of a different view of copyright in print, or at least there was in South Korea. So I've definitely come across, there have been people who, like in my sort of academic life, who've gone to give a talk in Korea or whatever and have discovered that their dissertation was being sold as a printed book you know, with the Korean cover and that sort of thing. It's like, all right, well.
Okay.
But anyway, so I thought it was just kind of funny to see it. Apart from the text at the top, it is just a knockoff Apple manual.
Is that cover the same that Apple used on the manual?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
And in fact, let's see. The manual is actually it's a really nice manual. It's the Integer Basic programming manual. So basically the Basic that Steve Wozniak wrote originally for the Apple II. And the text of it is written by Jeff Raskin, and it's actually really sort of playful. So it's fairly amusing read. I think it's more fun to read than the AppleSoft manual, which is the Microsoft derived Basic that came after this. But so if you're looking for a Basic manual to read, this actually is not a bad one to read.
And if you're looking for one that is fun to read, so it has the bonus.
Right. But it also reminded me a little bit of, so this is a tangent now, but there is a document called the Apple IIe Design Guidelines, which is basically like, you know, it's like the Apple design, Apple Interface Guidelines, essentially, but sort of in early form, right? I mean, like, so we're sort of familiar with these in like the Mac era about like how you're supposed to have the file and the edit menu and all that stuff, you know, and everything has to be doable by the mouse and all that stuff. But this is an earlier document that's basically just sort of talking about like, you know, what good human interfaces are like. And it's written by Bruce Tognazzini. Yes. Anyway, this actual document, the Apple IIe Design Guidelines document, is not very common, but it contains a really glorious anecdote. Let's see if I can find the anecdote here. Yes. Okay. Here it is. Herein follows a true anecdote that illustrates how difficult the most simple human interface issue can be and why thorough testing on real people is so important. And so, it's basically talking about the sort of demo disk Apple presents Apple that came with the 2E, and they were just sort of running through tests and they wanted to figure out like basically whether to use color or not. So the problem is that they wanted to like basically just ask the user, are they using a color monitor? So, the first design prompt was to ask, are you using a color TV? And the anticipated problem was that, people wouldn't know. So they went through a couple of tests to see, like, the first idea was they showed a color graphic above and they said, is the picture above in color? And 25%, failed. That's not so good. And so then they went to a second attempt and they had green, blue, orange, and magenta written in colors. And they asked, are the words above in color? And black and white monitor users correctly said no, right, that they were in black and white. Green screen monitor users completely failed because they were in color, they were in green. and this sort of like continues on, you know, like all the different, eventually the one that they succeeded on in the fifth iteration was, do the words above appear in several different colors?
Mm-hmm. But, interesting. Yeah, you don't, the Apple IIe, obviously, when you think about it, it's not the case, but it seems as if it's so far back that, you know, user interface testing and design guidelines aren't something you would, I was a little surprised to see that this book exists, I guess.
Right.
But yeah, it should exist. And, you know, this is, it's useful if entertaining.
And I mean, those kind of questions about how to word something in your interface are still, people still struggle with it today. You know, there's still maybe not that, like, do you have a color screen or not? But it's like sort of how to tell people, you know, how to get a user to understand what you're asking them and actually answer to the question that you mean to be posing them. And I actually saw, you know, there's the classic thing of, you go to cancel some operation and you get up a modal that says, are you sure you want to do it? Cancel. Okay. Like, am I going to cancel the canceller or am I okay with it? Like, what? And like, this is kind of like this is sort of a trope. This is like something that is like an old rehashed thing. And this is present in the newest cars that Volvo sells in their navigation system. If you're navigating to somewhere you press the cancel button to cancel navigation, you get up a thing saying, are you sure you want to cancel? Cancel? Okay.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
So like user interface issues are perennial and like never go away.
But yeah, I guess it is interesting that they were focusing on this even back then.
Yes, I agree.
Okay, here's the next thing. Is this still available? It is. I have a search on eBay for various things, you know, Apple II and that kind of stuff. One of the things I was searching for was where in North Dakota is Carmen Sandiego, which I think we've talked about this a little bit before, but this is like the state of North Dakota commissioned Broderbund to like make a special version of the Carmen Sandiego game for North Dakota. And it's, you know, it's fairly obscure. Archive.org has a fairly elaborate archive of some materials from this project because the Video Game History Foundation actually went and like interviewed people and talked, you know, gathered the stuff that had to do with the creation of this. And, you know, so there's some small number, 5,000 or 1,000 or something like that, that actually kind of went out to schools in North Dakota. But, you know, like you don't find these. So I have a, I had a search on eBay just in case, you know, that's what they, one ever surfaced. And yesterday it actually hit something. Like I kind of never expected it would. So this is a, it's a disc, you know, has no label. I think if you look at it really closely, you can kind of see that there's some glue residue for where a label used to be.
It looks like a hole punch notch on the back. It looks like a rounded hole punch, you know, like a paper hole punch notch rather than square.
Yep, on it's the a image homemade punch.
Yeah.
So I don't know what this is. You know, I don't think we're going to know, but until somebody gets it, and even then. But, I mean, essentially, my guess is that, just based on kind of like the other things that the seller has as well, that this is an actual copy of this program that was sort of like illegitimately passed around back in the late 80s, right? I mean, like, so...
So the image is available, right? The disk image is on, is preserved?
Yeah, as I mean, as part of that effort.
Yeah.
Okay. That, you know, going and interviewing the creators and that sort of thing. And apparently there was a, like, an initial sort of internal testing version that wasn't copy protected, and there was at least a defaced one that went around, back in the day, you know, so that had, like, cracked by such and such on the front. So, I mean, like, this game does exist, and it's quite possible that the cracked one is the one that's on that floppy that's in the auction. That's my guess, is that it's just, you know, something that someone, a copy that someone made for their friend and passed it around. But I but my guess is also that it was done in the 80s, you know, or 89 or whatever. So it's a, it is vintage in a certain sense, even if it isn't an original.
It would be quite something to get a hold of the box that the South Dakota came in. I think I saw a photograph of that in some of the materials you showed, if that actually was printed, which I guess it was.
It would be amazing if it ever came up on eBay. I didn't think, as I said, I didn't think my search was going to ever hit anything, but it did. So
I'm afraid to ask how many eBay searches you have standing right now.
Many. I have, you know, as many as they're allowed, I think. I don't know. Let's see. The next one I had. I don't know what to make of this. This also seems like it's a potentially just kind of like a knockoff of some sort. It is a shopping bag that says Apple Makes Sense, Apple Computer, and has this like big red apple on it. It doesn't actually look like branding that Apple itself would ever have used.
No,
it doesn't. Even the phrase Apple Makes Sense doesn't sound like a phrase they would have used.
Right.
So, yeah.
It's written in the appropriate, you know, the era appropriate font. It has the Apple logo on it, so they would definitely have, you know, sued them if they knew about it. One thing I might point out is that the S's here in Apple Makes Sense, they're the S's from the Modern Tectura font. They're not the S's that you usually find them using. So, like, the S in Silent Type and the S in Disk 2 don't look like that. They're done differently. So they... Apple did not use this sort of drop S that is in the Modern Tectura font. So that's one reason why I might doubt this.
That's a big reason to doubt it, I think.
I wonder if I can find Apple Disk 2. You can sort of see the S in disk 2 is, it's, you know, it's just, it doesn't look anything like the Modern Tectura one. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, whatever. If you're looking for more bags to go make friends with, and you want a knockoff Apple bag, there's one. Are there more things to talk about? Yeah, all right. So, someone is selling a Digitizer 2 PCB. This is basically a blank card with no components on it. But it is for the Digitizer, which is like a video cap or like an image capture card. Mm. A very old one for the Apple II. It's created by Computer Stations, Inc. And I wonder, I do kind of wonder, actually, if there, you have enough information on this card to be able to build it. I bet you don't.
Probably not.
Like, I bet you would really need to know, like, what chips to get and that sort of thing. But anyway, it's sort of interesting that it exists. I don't know why it exists. Because, I mean, this is definitely something that they sold, you know, and you bought them and you could, you know, in fact, I think I have the manual for it. I don't have an actual Digitizer 2 card, but I have a manual for it. So I don't know how the seller came across these, but they look old. I mean, they look like they're from 1980-ish.
Manufacturing remainders, just like leftover bits that never get built.
Apparently there's nothing else on eBay except those PCBs. I mean, I think they are somewhat rare. There was another one that was called, I think, Computer Eyes, that was a little bit more well-known.
Yeah, I remember Computer Eyes everywhere. Yeah, yeah. Like, ads for those were everywhere.
Yeah, and I think those existed for several platforms, too. I don't think they were just for
Atari, the Commodore.
Yeah. I looked around, because we were talking about terminals, I looked around for VT220, you know, because we are doing episode 220. And they're actually pretty expensive, so they're pretty hard to get. But this was a fixer-upper that has a keyboard and the terminal itself. The keyboards themselves go for a fair amount. It seems like the thing that doesn't work about it is that the monitor all shows in a single line. I think this is a known kind of defect that these CRTs can have. I mean, not just these, but I mean, like any CRTs can have. I don't know what the solution is, but people know how to fix it. And I think this is not so expensive for such a thing. And this $145 buy it now. To me, shipping from Florida is an additional $80 shipping. But if you're looking for one of these, this is probably not
terrible, especially if you know how to fix a CRT. Or you know someone who knows how to fix a CRT.
Because, I mean, like, most of the other ones I saw were, like, $400,
right.
$400, $500. And, like, I'm not sure if any of these are prices that are appropriate to pay. But, I mean, like, if you really wanted one, then my guess is that the one that I was showing before is not too bad because I think it is fairly fixable. And it looks kind of nice. Anyway. Okay. Two more things I have on my list. One is a portfolio set, just because, I don't know, I find the portfolio kind of cute. This seems to have a lot of stuff.
Yeah, so, all that for $54, that is cheap.
Yeah, so far. It is.
Yeah, it's 5 days left.
So. Yeah, if it was buy it now, I would buy it.
Yeah.
Right.
In a heartbeat. Cool.
Looks like it's working. It looks like it has all the various cable options and some software and
nice. I still haven't done anything with mine really.
Yeah.
Take some time with it.
It is kind of a cool thing and all that, but what would you do with it?
I'm not sure.
I mean, isn't it, this is the one that you use to hack ATMs or whatever, right? I mean, like, that's
right. If you're in the Terminator 2 movie, that's what you use to hack it. I just kind of want to, just for the heck of it, I want to follow through the guide that I found that lets you, because I have the serial port interface for it. I want to interface that with something, and then there's a way you can, using the DOS cat command, you can like take the input from the serial port, put it into a file. So it's possible to sort of like transfer over to it a simple utility that will let you start doing more stuff, actually grabbing files and doing things that are interesting from it. So
cool.
But I'm not there yet.
Yeah. Well, good luck. And no, I mean, like, so this auction already has 7 bids, and so people have noticed it. That's one thing about my slow editing turnaround is that certainly I, except for the few people who are actually watching the stream, and hello, people who are watching the stream, you know, I'm not giving anyone any jump on any of these. I'm not right. increasing the competition because they're all ended by the time I post the thing.
Yep. But, oops.
Anyway, so then the last one I had was just a ThinkPad, which is a little bit funny, I guess. I mean, it's a joke that the actual auction author made, but it is an IBM ThinkPad. It is a little notepad that says Think on it from IBM.
Yeah, that's how they started.
Yeah. $20 buy it now. It's actually not, I mean, you know, if you want that joke.
Wait, now, is this little notepad something that IBM launched around the time they launched the ThinkPad computer, or is it something they had before?
Long before.
I think it's older. I think it is, you know, I think is like a branding word they used for a while.
Yeah, I think it was a corporate evangelism thing. It would be like, everyone gets this, you know, think, mm-hmm. you know, transcend, you know, I think. And that's where I think the ThinkPad itself, I'd read the history somewhere, was an homage to, you know, to that employee provided thing, and which okay. is kind of yeah. cool. You know, I get it.
But it does. In fact, the auction title is original IBM ThinkPad.
Like, you know, he's not wrong.
Yeah. Anyway, that's it. That's it for me.
Neat.
I think we've made it through our auctions. Yeah. We can move to the closing discussions. Blake, any closing thoughts?
I don't really have any particular closing thoughts. I guess I will repeat the same closing thought that I've had for the past 9 episodes, which is the links reminded me I still haven't gotten that HP 100 LX working, and maybe I never will. But maybe by this time in the next few episodes, I will have figured out that cable issue on the ZX Spectrum Plus. We'll see.
All right.
Cool.
Jack, any closing thoughts?
Not too much going on for me retro-wise. I guess I think I mentioned to you guys at some point before that after my father passed away, that there was a small trove of Atari 8-bit stuff that was in his house. Hmm. And I have now successfully moved all of that stuff into my home. So I have both an 800XL, a 1040 or 1050 drive, and I have a little 300 baud modem. It was the 1030, I think.
Hmm.
Not much I can do with that modem, but
yeah,
it's kind of fun to have all the pieces. I haven't done anything with any of that lately, but kind of good to have sort of all that stuff. It's funny, so in the 80s when I was a kid and I had the Atari 8-bits, and I would go visit him in the summertime, and at some point he bought some of these things also. I mean, he had PCs at that time also, and he bought these things. And I remember, like, I had those things, I would use them summertime, but he was really not kind of into it. And then sometime many years later, I saw these things kind of boxed up or bagged up in his house. And I was like, wow, what? I was like, hey, Dad, why'd you ever even buy that stuff because you were not into it all? And he's like, well, maybe I was trying to connect with my 13-year-old son. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, got me.
It worked.
Duh.
Nice.
Yeah.
So.
Nice.
Yeah, it's cool that you got it there. I have some stuff here. But I just haven't had time. That's the problem. So I have lots of stuff I want to try to do.
Yeah, I actually bought last year. I bought this thing for the 8-bits. There's this Ultimate 1 MB upgrade you can install, and I was going to install it in the 600XL that I have, and then I was looking online and realized that I think it's a little bit too big and bulky. I think I would need to do some weird hacking around, but I think in the 800XL it will fit nicely, so I'll just install them there instead.
Excellent.
When I get around to it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I realize that I don't have a soldering iron here. So, I mean, I suppose I could just have Amazon ship me one. Yeah. It's probably easier than going to my office and getting it.
You can buy one.
Yeah. For me, I don't know. Yeah, the semester is coming up and many things are not done yet. So that's largely what's taking up my time. I've spent a fair amount of time doing, like, I'm kind of responsible for our department website. And at the beginning of the summer, I thought, well, you know, what would be a fun idea would be to learn React.js, mm-hmm. The web framework.
Sure.
And that seemed like a better idea when the summer was beginning than now as the summer is ending and the project needs to be done and it's not. And I'm, you know, learning about JavaScript. I don't know. Anyway, whatever. I mean, like, you know, it's just another language that has just its own little syntax. And the trick is trying to remember, because I'm doing a project that is Ruby and Rails and React. And, you know, like trying to keep straight where all the brackets are supposed to be is not that easy. So
that's interesting. It was, yeah, I had to, like, I've been primarily a front-end web developer for like the past 6 years. I had kind of a mix back in front, but coming into this position I have now, I was gearing up on Angular, which is an older sort of similar AngularJS, and you know, haven't gone far down that road with actual products, but I think React is you know, in my future, I think React might be, you know, kind of the one that's, you know, leaning more towards a wider usage and bigger future, but yeah, I can feel what you're talking about. It's definitely a different way of doing front end, you know, front end JavaScript, but makes for a nice application.
It's fun. I mean, like the thing is, like if there weren't the time pressure, it would be fun.
Sure.
But I definitely went through that same, you know, like I realized that I wanted to split the back and front end. And, you know, so I probably wanted to do some kind of JavaScript front end. And then you wind up in this like months long, like, okay, which is the one that's still going to be around in 9 months?
Right. Right.
You know?
Yeah. Not to go on a big tangent, but yeah, oddly, I've spent most of my, you know, most of the time I've done back end work. Now I do both. I like an equal split if I can get it, which I usually can. But, we're actually using primarily Cold Fusion on the back end, which right. is, yeah, kind of a language you don't, you know, hear quite as much, but it's big in academic and government. And, I actually, spent some time in my past on that in a different post, but, I'm actually quite fond of it, but it's not a lot of people are, you know, let's start anew and we'll pick Cold Fusion. But, right.
Yeah, that anyway. Doesn't seem like,
but it's, you know,
there was a time when I spent a fair amount of time writing, in, I'm not actually even sure how to call it, but active server pages. Mm-hmm. So
ASP.net it went through all kind of different. I did that too. That was my before, it's like Lotus Script and then ASP.net, active server pages, VB Script, you know, all that JScript.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all of this does make me realize, like, I do want to pick one that's going to be around in 9 months because I really just don't want to learn a new thing.
Right.
I mean, part of the reason I'm working on this thing in the first place is because I let it go too long, so it's too hard to upgrade. You know, like, I can't make it anymore to the step N plus one that it's at because, like, all the servers no longer respond.
But, just use Perl for everything.
Yeah. Just write everything in assembly. The other thing the other note I had made here was that there are magnets everywhere. I think we probably talked about that already, but I did a little experiment. Like, I have a disk imaging device here, and I wrote a new disk on, you know, like I made a new Apple II disk, and then I set it on my laptop's, you know, like palm rest for, I think 5 minutes. I think I timed it to 5 minutes, and then I imaged it again, and there's like this big magnetic, you know, like
smear
damaged, like the whole disk is unreadable pretty much at this point. And so don't put your disks that you're imaging on your laptop I sort of suspected that because I was realizing I have these like little twist ties all over the place, and they stick to stuff. They stick to my headphones and they stick to my laptop and stuff. And I'm noticing, you know, like I used to be terrified of magnets, and now there are magnets everywhere. And
watch your iPad if it's got a case.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, like, it turns out that the palm rest did a lot more damage than either my AirPods or my iPad. But I mean, like, I've got piles of disks here, and I want to image them before I erase them, if possible.
Right,
it's a good sequence.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is really this, like, as you're doing this imaging, it's very tempting to just set the disk down there, so you type in the metadata. But don't do that. Don't do that. Or at least do that, like, after the image, but preferably don't do that at all.
Right.
Anyway, all right. I think that was all that I had as closing thoughts. And Jack is probably melting, so.
A little bit. It's all right.
So that's it for the show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.net. And if you want, you can write a review on iTunes. That, in principle, will help people find the show. And then, I guess, until next time,
Retro Compute!